Blog Talk Radio.
I am the daughter of the ancient mother. I am the child of the mother of the world. I am the daughter of the ancient mother. I am the child of the mother of the world.
Good evening and welcome, Gaias and fans of Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Whether you're across town or across the globe, as I always say, we are one big and growing family. So I thank you for tuning in and sending all the great emails and guest ideas and articles to share. Thanks to everyone who's marked our show a favorite on Blog Talk and telling your friends about the show and our treasure of archives that go back 2.5 years now. Can you believe it's been that long? And in case you didn't know, and especially if you weren't on my email list, you can click a button on my show page on Blog Talk and reminders of the show will automatically be sent to your website. Then you're sure not to miss anything. And, you know, Mother's Day is not that far away. It's just around the corner. I wanted to share some food for thought for this year. Nothing you probably haven't heard before, but think of this as maybe words of encouragement because you deserve it and you probably always put everyone else first most days. If you're a mother, and that means not just the creatrix of flesh and blood babies, but the creatrix of movements and books and projects or organizations, you see what I mean, you should pamper yourself. Send everyone out if you don't live alone. Soak in a hot bubble bath with candles and some favorite music in the background. Or sit in your garden or on your balcony or your most comfy chair and read that book you've been promising yourself you'd get to. Or go to the movies with a friend and see something you want to see instead of what the kids want to see or he wants to see. And maybe even treat yourself to something delicious. Whatever it is for you, just pamper yourself. And then do something for Mother Earth. Make it her time to be honored, too, for all she provides. Maybe light a candle and say a prayer of thanks. Make an offering of milk or beer to Mother Earth. Pick up trash on your street or on a section of the beach. Make a commitment to start living green. Think about where and how you can volunteer. Just find a way that feels right to you to honor the creatrix within and outside yourself and step into your queen. Anyway, those were just some thoughts. Tonight our guest is the foremother Max Dashew of the Suppressed Histories Archives, and we have a jam-packed show for you. Besides telling us about the 40th anniversary of the archives, we hope to get to some tantalizing topics. Let's see, some of those include the Iberian Tanit, and Max is going to talk about her collection that's being digitized. So we have lots to cover tonight. But before we do, because you've asked me to, some of you emailed me and asked me to repeat what I've said before at the close of a What's the Buzz segment, sort of to set a tone, as one of you called it. So here goes. This is for you. Let's remember, we not only have to be educated, we have to be informed and aware. We have to know who has our best interests in mind and who will use us, then throw us under the bus. We have to know what's going on out there in the world, even when it's easier to just bury our heads in the sand because it feels so overwhelming at times, or so complicated, or so divisive, maybe sometimes even hopeless. And dare I say, we take it a bit farther than just being informed or aware. We have to reclaim our sacred feminine voice. You've heard me call it the roar before. I've talked about it in the context of the ancient Greek priestesses and how they served humanity, and I've likened it to the roar of Sekhmet, the great she, and by extension, us. Women everywhere and our like-minded brothers must claim our feminine roar or voice. When the great she roars, she's saying, I'm alive, I'm here, I'm growing stronger every day. I offer you the tools for a sustainable future. I offer women empowerment and men partnership. I provide all you need for a joyful and abundant life. Hear me roar. And we are her voice, her hands, her feet in this life. This, too, is what the Dalai Lama meant when he said Western women will save the world. So stand up, speak up, work together, and support other women. Change the world. Goddess is the dark horse coming from behind to win the race. Well, you like that?
That was wonderful.
Well, you know, I've said that before, and a couple people said, oh, please say it again. So there we go. I guess I'll have to repeat that every now and again. It makes me feel good, too.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see. Later on in the hour, please stay tuned for What's the Buzz, for what some of you call the favorite part of the show, when I let those bees that have been buzzing around in my bonnet out. And if you're not familiar with What's the Buzz? It's when we talk about things going on out there in the world that are in sync with or opposing ideas of the sacred feminine. And just some of these ideals include partnership, justice, harmony, balance, tolerance, negotiation, wisdom, and certainly not exploitation of Mother Earth, resources, or people. You've been telling me you want to hear more about these sorts of things and What's the Buzz, maybe go in depth a bit more, not to rush it. So I'm working on that, and I'm glad for your feedback. And so you'll know what's ahead later on tonight after Max and I finish our chat. We're going to talk about the Nebraska governor who signed an anti-abortion law for his state, how the Republicans spin their lies so well and the intended consequences. The governor of Virginia, who makes no bones about being racist, sexist, and homophobic. Sarah Palin's $12 million. Ron Paul, who says Obama is not a socialist. With some of the benefits of workers, of workers if we really did live in a socialist country. And fundamentalists, a lot of damn and not a lot of mental. The scheme of the Tea Party Express revealed. And that new book, Get Rich Cheating. So stay tuned with me till the bottom of the hour. We'll cover these themes, open the show to callers, and share some important announcements and some great music. So remember, to speak to me or my guest, Max, tonight, you can call in at 718-766-4662. I know from your emails, a lot of you listen from the archives, but if you're there live with us, please do call in and say hello, offer your comments or your questions. And thanks to our new artists who have generously allowed me to play their music for your enjoyment on the show. Tonight's opening song you heard was a snippet. It's from Lisa Thiel. She's a local LA artist. And the song was Song to Inanna. But if you want more information about the music, go to Lisa's website, sacreddream.com. And you'll be hearing a lot more of her stuff because I really like just about everything she does. Okay, and now to tonight's guest, for Mother Max Dachau. I don't want to keep her waiting any longer. And Max, tell me, is it Dachau or is it, what's
Dachau? Dachau.
Dachau. Okay, great. Well, now Max has been on the show a couple times. I think tonight, during the life of the show, tonight might actually be her third or fourth appearance. And in case you don't recognize her name or you haven't heard her before, let me tell you a little bit about her. She teaches global women's history and goddess traditions. In 1970, she founded the Suppressed Histories Archive to research female shaman, mother right cultures, and the history of domination. Drawing on her collection of over 15,000 slides, she presents visual talks at universities, conferences, and community centers. I've been to several, and they are always excellent. She's published posters on female icons and sacred vulva, and a DVD, Women's Power and Global Perspectives, is available. And she's completing the first volume of The Secret History of the Witches, which looks at priestesses, oracles, goddesses, and ceremony in ancient Egypt. And she's an artist who paints bold and spirited women. So, Max, thank you so much for being on the show again.
Thank you, Karen. It was great to come in on Lisa Thiel. I love her stuff.
She is. Isn't she wonderful? I mean, I don't think I've heard anything that she's done that I haven't liked. And, you know, that's saying a lot for me. I'm not one that, you know, music isn't the center of my life, but her stuff always makes me feel good.
One correction on the book is that
sure.
It's not about priestesses. I mean, there actually is a little bit about priestesses in ancient Egypt, but it's actually about what happened in Europe. And so just as far as the folk of secret history of the witches is concerned.
Oh, okay. All right. I must have read that wrong on the bio. So thanks for correcting
mm-hmm.
that. But one of the reasons you're on tonight is it's the 40th anniversary of the Suppressed Histories Archives.
Yes.
So why don't you tell us a bit about that?
Well, I really found before there was women's studies that it was impossible to study what I wanted to know about in college, and so I struck out as an independent scholar at the very beginning of 1970 and began researching on my own and reading just about everything I could lay out my hands on, because back then there wasn't as much concentrated information as there is now about women, about Native North America, and a lot of things. And so eventually I named the project the Suppressed Histories Archives, because I put women at the center, but in order to understand what happened with women, you have to have a much broader outlook than what people normally think about when they think about women's history. You have to look at ancient studies, archaeology, indigenous studies. You have to have a very global perspective in order to get the full depths of what the female experience has been in the world and what's happened to us, what the historical transformations have been that have thrown us to where we are now, all of us.
Well, I can imagine that. Well, I mean, I know from, you know, they always say, you know, they want us to remember, you know, when Women's History Month rolls around, the big, huge gaps in women's history. So I would imagine back then when you started, this must have been an incredible task to undertake.
Well, you know, you could look, I mean, in those days it was card catalogs, and there was very little under women, first of all. And then what you found was overwhelmingly European, overwhelmingly, you know, pretty close to modern. And, you know, I see so much interrelationship between the anti-racist struggle and the struggle to overcome patriarchy because of the way both women and, you know, all the various colonized groups have been sequestered in libraries. There's this disregard, and then there are certain pockets where you'll find us segregated, rather than running as a thread through everything. And so a lot of what I see my work as being is provisional, because we have to deal with the quality of the sources we have, you know, to work with, and also as something expansive to try and expand people's idea of who women have been. And, you know, drawing on multiple kinds of sources, not just history and not just the literary record, but looking at oral traditions, looking at archaeology, linguistics, lots of things that need to be woven back together, because the web of culture in so many cases has been torn and shredded, and we need this reweaving is what's going on now as we're beginning to recover those positive heritages we have and to get a grip on what the true human cultural experiences are.
Well, you know, I would imagine that part of the problem was that most of the information and reference material that was out there, you know, maybe was the body of work of men, and maybe they just didn't find women's roles in culture as interesting. Is that a safe assumption? Or
that is a safe assumption, and white men, and elite men, and, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, even, you can also look at areas like in China or in the Arab world, you also have elite authors who are recording things, and they act as gatekeepers. What did they allow through? What did they not allow through? And even those sources we can use those, but I think we're going to have a period of catch-up where the new scholars are coming through and saying, well, what really is in the Iranian written record? You know, in these societies that have been literate for a long time, or in the Japanese record, or wherever you want to go. And so there's this process of recovery that has to go on. But you're right. I mean, there, a lot of what we were taught was history, and this is one reason so many people were so bored by it. It belonged only to certain people. It was kings and warlords and generals and all of that, stories of wars and battles and dates, rather than this really rich fabric of what are all these waves of human interaction that have been going on. It's a very complex weave of peoples and cultures and religious movements and technological developments and interchanges, as well as the domination history, which leads us into oppressive laws and caste and slavery and conquest and not least patriarchy. And how all those things tie together, that gets really juicy.
Well, you know, so we obviously had a gender gap, but I would also imagine there was probably, I hope I'm using the right word here, maybe a culture gap too, because the people that used to have the leisure time and money to record things were probably rich male elites, and you certainly weren't getting the perspective of the washerwoman or the female shaman from the white male elites either. And ethnographers. I know when I was researching my own book, I had a heck of a time, you know, finding really good stuff on Polynesia, because the missionaries had sanitized so much, or what they wrote through, you know, maybe a Christian lens or something, or maybe language was a problem. You know, a Polynesian word didn't exactly translate into an English word. So it seems like it's just so easy to really either never get to the to some information, and then also maybe get to the true meaning as well.
Well, all those things you named are factors. And you've got outright omission or suppression, destruction, bias, and then all those other filters of, well, maybe they didn't really interpret it right. I mean, classic is anthropology, early anthropology. You had these white men going to all these cultures, like places like Australia, and saying, oh, well, they're totally male-dominated because, you know, they're only listening to the men, and then they're interpreting it through their own worldview, and then carrying that back partly as proof that men have always dominated. And so then later, you have it's still external, because this is not still the voice of the Australian Aboriginal people themselves, but you have women anthropologists going in and saying, well, wait a minute, the women are telling us something different, and actually it looks like this. And now we're getting to the stage where finally the indigenous voices are starting to be foregrounded, and you're starting to have authentic cultural testimony from inside, you know, as literacy spreads, and you get people who have fought their way into the academic sphere, which is very inhospitable, you know, just based on the biases that are built into it, and they are beginning to critique all that's passed before and saying, no, you have to listen to the oral histories. You have to look at what our keepings tell us about the symbols, because there's such a strong literate bias to all of this. And right now in archaeology, there's a whole controversy and debate going over who gets to interpret. Should it be only the elite gatekeepers who are, you know, the postdoctoral candidates, primarily European and American, less so now than before, but still primarily those are the voices. They've shaped the discourse, and their literate biases talking about what the ancient female figurines represent, and in many cases saying, no, you can't call them goddesses, a whole topic in itself. Or is it going to be people who are looking at certain signs that recur in what I call the scripture of signs that you find in rock art, ceramics, especially painted ceramics, and in very ancient times, that was a female art form. Not only art form, but a mode of passing on philosophy and knowledge through those symbols, stories behind them. And so that leads you into something comparative and something that really savors of the deep continuities between cultures who had nothing to do with each other in terms of geographic or historical context. These are things that arise independently. And so we can start looking at that and learning from it. I mean, we're in this process of gathering.
Well, two questions for you. First, is about you. What inspired you to go your own way? Was it the liberation of being able to do your own thing? I mean, how did you, go? How did you choose the path you took? And the second question, which is, I don't think it's, totally related, but what's wrong with academia? And by that, I mean, why is it when new information comes along or fresh sets of eyes look at things, why are they seem anyway so, set in their traditional thought? Why isn't it easy for them to say, okay, well, this new information, so we have to change our mind and rewrite things? It's like they're invested in an idea rather than the truth or accuracy.
Well, it's very complicated, but what you're talking about is the reason that I left college at the time. Of course, it was also 1968, and all the anti-war protests were going on, and there were multiple reasons why I felt like maybe this ruling class college is not the place I should be right now. But I was a scholarship student. I didn't feel like I had any rank, and so how was I going to be able to write papers for professors who I knew would grade me down for saying things they disagree with? there's a doctrinal thing, and I want to say that there's a lot of good people who are scholars in academia who are interested in expansive vision, and there's valid things to the idea of being able to document and authenticate what you're saying. It's just that there's this problem in a broad pattern of doctrinal attitudes, and where I really hit up against it first was I was taking an anthropology course. And they were saying, oh, well, there are these matrilineal cultures, but it doesn't mean anything. Men have always dominated in all societies throughout time. And I could not, at that point, disprove that to them, but I really had to...
You had your doubts.
I knew intuitively that was wrong. My undertaking was to try and gather evidence and see what, in fact, it looked like. And that involved doing a scan of the world, and it was on multiple levels. It's like, okay, one of my first intuitions is non-dominance types of societies, which are not class rank, which are not imperial, are probably more likely to have female-male egalitarianism. So I began looking for those, and then I thought, well, also to find them, I had no idea where that was true and where that was not true. I mean, it really involved doing a global historical study as well as to where the empires were, where were the military powers, because that was something that I felt would be correlated with male domination, militarization and conquest.
That would probably thwart matrilineal cultures. Is there a connection there? Or?
Yeah, and there. In fact, we know of evidence for that. For example, in China, the builder of the Great Wall, one of the groups that he dragooned into forced labor was matrilocal husbands. And so you find cases like that. You find the missionaries in many parts of the world demanding that they give up egalitarian cultural models, their aboriginal ways, and to abandon matrilineage and take on not only patrilineage, but really male-dominant forms. There's a book that's called Chain Her by One Foot, where this scholar gathered together the evidence that was left by the missionaries in eastern Canada, the Jesuits, who were trying to condition Indian men to beat their wives and force them into submission. And so, there's a lot of evidence for that kind of a patriarchalization that accompanied conquest in so many cases.
Well, and for listeners' benefit, too, I mean, who might think that this only happened a long time ago. I mean, I was just listening to a documentary on PBS a couple months ago about a matrilineal culture in China today had been doing really well, but, outside forces didn't like it and started working against it, and so they tried to put prostitution on the outskirts of town and all different things that would sort of work against those traditional ways, and gradually they were, you know, they're worried that it's going to start to crumble.
That's the most war culture you're talking about, right? The most war in Yunnan?
It might be. I honestly don't remember. I was just so amazed, you know, that here they were given evidence of these positive attributes of a matrilineal culture in contemporary times, and you know, and here nobody on the outside world sees the benefit of it. You know, when the women are saying, you know, this is, you know, they want to keep things this way, but the men are being too tempted to. You know, to give up the old ways, and I mean, it was really sad.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of the Moskva are one of the. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
The Moskva are one of the most egalitarian cultures I've found, and when the Chinese communists took over, they tried to force them into the Han patrilineal marriage model with the husband as authority, and it was devastating. But even that did not destroy their culture, and now they're facing mobs of tourists who are descending on them and asking them insulting questions about their culture, which is being really sexualized in this really smarmy way, you know, as far as the fact that they traditionally did not have marriage as we understand it. And
wow.
So it's you know, very, I mean, this is, they're in every indigenous society is facing these types of pressures. Maybe not tourism in some cases. In other places, it may be, you know, poisoning by oil mining or other kinds of resource extraction and being driven off their lands. You know, so
are there other matrilineal cultures that we can actually point to that are still around today?
Sure. There's lots, and some are remnants of what they, you know. There's been a lot of change in the last century, especially, so that there has been impact. But you have the Minangkabau in Sumatra, which is part of Indonesia. You have the Wayuu in northern Colombia and Venezuela. Some of the Arawakan peoples around different parts of South America. You've got, of course, the Pueblo nations here in the United States. There's many examples, and this is all, they're all very, very much threatened by the patterns that are affecting all indigenous peoples, whether they're patrilineal or matrilineal, you know, whether they're mother right cultures or whether they're more patriarchal. So,
And just for the benefit of listeners who might not know what that mother right culture is, I think I'd be remiss not to ask you to maybe just give a brief definition.
Sure. I'm saying that I like to say that instead of matriarchy. And some people are reclaiming the term matriarchy, but I like mother right because it emphasizes the lineage from the mother, which is one of the core principles of it, and the right not only to the mother and from the mother, but of the mother. You know, you have this basically an egalitarian culture where the reason that is so much more beneficial for human society is that if you enforce patriarchy, the only way to really have a patrilineage is to have a sexual double standard where women are subject to sometimes violence or other severe types of repression in order to force the knowledge that, yes, this guy is the father of the child, and therefore the line can be preserved, property can be passed down through the line. And so that's what's led us through, you know, when you read all of these grisly things that have been done, like stoning to death and burying alive and lots of other horrific things that have been done to women who broke the chastity code or the wifely fidelity or servile marriage even, then you begin to understand why mother right is an important alternative. Now, the way we were taught about it, and this is still being taught to a large extent this way in a lot of anthropology courses, is that, in fact, human society is male-dominated. And so they teach you that, but then what are we to make of the fact that there are these societies, like the Moskva, they had female clan heads. The men weren't subjected to the women, brothers and sisters. That was the clan. That was the members of the clan. The brothers would go out. They would have love affairs. They'd go overnight with their lovers. They would come back in the morning. They would farm the lands of their mothers. That was their lands too. And so you had basically, and one of the beauties of this, their system, and I think this is true in general of mother right cultures, in their don't want to say their pure form because that sounds weird, but, you know, before they became really impacted by customs or accretions of domination, is that the economic relationship of the family, the ones who gather food, hunt, farm, or whatever it is that they're doing, is separated from love matches. And that means that the children's well-being is not at all threatened by breakups or divorces or any kinds of the kind of earthquakes that tend to go on emotionally when relationships don't work out. The children
right.
remain in the home. They have their home. They're never going to lose their home or their people. And the women are not going to become cast out without possessions after 30, 40 years either.
So the assets for the family unit, so to speak, stay with the mothers and the children.
Yes. Yes. And that's right. And then, you know, as I was saying, the men participate, the uncles are important, and there's very much more a complementary system. A lot of times you'll see people describing patriarchy as complementary gender roles, but there you have dominance of one group. You have privilege on one side, obedience and duty on the other side. And so it's a very different picture because there's no sovereignty for the women inside those systems. Their power is contingent. It's conditional. And it can be taken away. You know, you can work farming and gathering wealth for many decades, and then your husband can divorce you and keep all that wealth. He can buy new wives with that wealth in some places.
It sounds like really what we're saying to a certain extent, and maybe it's obvious, and maybe I'm just stating the obvious, but there is an equality, and that seems to be a major part of it in the patrilineal, you know, way of doing things in a lot of cases. Because the powers in the hands of the male not equally shared between
them. And you could even break it down more, because the older men can prevent younger men from having wives. They can take the young women for themselves, or they can give their daughters to the guy because they're going to get something out of it themselves. It's not necessary. Theoretically, it's predicated on everybody's welfare, but in practice and in reality, it may, and in fact often is, based on very crass considerations. And so you have young men who can't have partners. So there are ways that dominated men inside those systems also suffer, and that's especially true where, and it usually is, in a strongly patrilineal or in a strongly patriarchal system, that the classes, you have social classes or wealth differentiations going on as well. And so there are many other kinds of subordinated groups, and we could name gays, we could name any number of people who are being forced into a very rigid template of gender and of domination.
Well, a quick question about the fathers, and then let's, you know, go on and talk about something else. If the uncles and the brothers are important male figureheads in the matrilineal or mother right societies, do the children know who the father is? I mean, is father called father, or is it, you know, or is it the men in their lives mostly, I don't know, maybe their grandparents or uncles or brothers?
They know the fathers. I mean, maybe not in all cases, because maybe there was some ambiguity there if the mother had several lovers. I mean, it's not necessarily guaranteed. But I think the people who are wrong who say, oh, there was matrilineage because they didn't know about the mechanics of sexuality and reproduction, I think that's totally wrong. And number two, I think that, and this we know from looking at any number of Pueblo societies, they know who the father is. It's just not the basis of social organization, you know, which
and
is
I
something
where
the, essentially
where that would
unstable.
Be real- And, mm-hmm. and that would be really threatening. I think that would be really threatening for men who, you know, have grown up with this idea, you know, this ego trip of being the head of the household or whatever, you know, if they come from another culture, to suddenly, you know, strip him of that identity. I can, I mean, not that, not, I mean, personally, I see the benefits of mother right, matrilineal, but I can see why the men would have opposed it and fought it, because I'm sure they probably felt it diminished them. I mean, they weren't top dog.
Well, they've become accustomed to having a greater share of legal privilege. I mean, this is we've come some ways. We have some ways to go. When you think about the situation 150 years ago, the women and children were chattel in the Anglo-American legal system. And there are remnants of that still active. I know personally know of someone who had her children taken away from her because she was a lesbian and a pagan. And she had no place to stand in court. The judges all hated her. And so that's still, you know, those factors are still active. And so, you know, there certainly is that belief by many men that they belong on top, that they should be in charge and they should get a greater share of power, and that's going to take some time to overturn. But I think that there's also ways that education is required, and I think that there are also ways that when people see that how harmful this is on a broader social level, that, you know, there will be change. I think there are men that understand this.
Well, you know, it's you know, if anybody who doesn't believe this, I mean, all they have to do is think back just a real short period of time to Supreme Court Justice Sotomayor's, you know, the questioning by Congress. I mean, you know, these white men acting like, oh, heaven forbid, white male discrimination, reverse discrimination. It was really pathetic.
It was a tiny, tiny taste of their own medicine. Not even a large dose of it, but they couldn't stand it.
But I mean, you know, they were screaming like little girls. You know, it was sad. I mean, if it wasn't so pathetic, it would have been funny. Well, anyway, let's switch gears a bit and talk more about the Suppressed Histories Archive. Now, I know in your digitized collection, you're going to have lots of good stuff. You sent me a list. You have treasures of African women, breasts, Shi Wang Mu, female icons, women in rock art, female liberators, animal goddesses and spirits, the unknown world, that's cultures most people never hear about, and the suppressed histories of Afghanistan. Did you want to talk about any of those in particular?
I wanted to say to start with, I'm just beginning this process of digitizing the archives, so I've got 5% of the shows digital so far. Or maybe even less, because I keep inventing these. There's new show seedlings are starting, like the one that you said, Rock Art, Unknown Worlds. Those are just things that I went through all of my digital archives, which is also several thousands by now of images and growing, and pulled things out in topics I wanted to, for the benefit we just had, to show people the range, because a lot of people think, oh, she does goddesses, and I do goddesses. I do sacred women and priestesses and shamans and all of that, and I do mother right, but I also talk about patriarchies and empire, and there's a lot of regional shows as well. So I'm in the process of some of the ones that are now digital, like you named Afghanistan. There's another one on Iberia, which is ancient Spain and Portugal, and another one on the Aegean and the Cretan and Greek world. Those are full-length presentations that are in digital form. And then there's all these shorter ones, like breasts. I was just finding, I was tossing images into folders and thinking, okay, you know, maybe this will be something for the anniversary, for the 40th anniversary. And it's like I wound up with a big pile of fascinating breast images, everything from gold plate beaten breast plates from ancient Colombia, from the Quimbaya culture, the Tairona culture, to carved wooden breasts from the Makonde people in East Africa, from the Dogon in West Africa, plaques with breasts from Cyprus, ivory breast, gorgeous little breast amulet from Bath in England, where the old shrine of Sul, the sun goddess, in southwestern England. And so I just kind of patched that all together because it's really fascinating to compare these seams cross-culturally. And you see these very potent symbols like spirals, vulva art, breasts, things that have just a very strong magnetism internationally coming up over and over again. And so I've been organizing those into these seedlings, which will eventually become full-length presentations. One of them is the Sacra Vulva is a show that I haven't fully digitized yet, but I've done a poster of it on the Numinous Female. And it has Sheila na Gigs from the islands, from Britain and Ireland, and as well as vulva stones from Serbia and Ecuador and the Iroquois country, just lots of different places, African carvings, beaten gold amulets from the Semitic world, and Mexican ceramics and stone monoliths from Nicaragua, and this bark paintings, Australia, just a whole collection celebrating the vulva as a sacred presence, as a blessing and protective power. And so this is something that I consider medicine for us.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially the way we women need to, you know, reclaim our sacred blood and our sacred sexuality, absolutely.
Which has been so colonized and bought and sold.
Well, and look, today you have pharmaceutical companies saying, oh, just take this pill, it'll go away. young women today, you know, just get all the wrong messages, and if they don't have the benefit of some of these thoughts, types of ideas, then, you know, it just makes me think women lose more and more and more. But let me ask you about the Sheila na Gig. I know that's kind of an enigma, and just in case listeners don't know about the Sheila, it's sort of an emaciated old hag that shows her genitals. Is that the best way to describe it? It sounds so derogatory,
yes,
and I don't think of her.
Well, they're usually crones. They're often hairless. Their ribs are often shown. Not all of them, but many of them are there. And so this is a different angle than what we're used to, clearly, with the whole pornified thing that's going on in our society. But I think they're emphasizing the ancestral woman, the grandmother figure, as the source. And so, and it's really interesting because the connection of the old woman and then this potent vulva, it goes against everything we've been taught. And yet in Ireland, there are still Sheila na Gigs where people walk what they call a patron. They walk this pattern around churches, sacred rocks, whatever it may be. And when they get to the Sheila, there's a ceremony of rubbing the vulva of the Sheila. Or another place
that
they may scrape out rock dust from her. Well, it's more than fertility. I mean, that is certainly one aspect, but there's a danger that's been sort of overdone as a concept. I mean, that's sort of like the bucket that everything gets thrown into. You could think of it maybe broadening it out more into vitality. It has blessing. It has protective power. It has healing power. There's a lot of aspects to it because basically, you know, we're dealing with life principle. As well as, I mean, the death principle is in there too. This is very broad, but people think of this as something that is blessing for them in whatever way they
need.
So when you
see the Sheila and she's this dichotomy of, you know, old emaciated hag with the vitality of her vulva, are we looking at goddess as, you know, from womb to tomb? Kind of a thing, you know, birth, death, rebirth, all right there in that image.
Yeah, I think so.
So when you see a Sheila, for instance, I know when we were in Ireland, and I forget exactly where this was, of course, but the Sheila is like, you know, right at the pediment of a building. And in some cases, you know, because of Christianity and stuff, they had done away with the Sheilas.
Yeah.
But if you saw her, say, for instance, at the top of a doorway, but it was a Christian church, for instance. What are people to take away from that? You know, is this just the mix of folk, folk religion with Christianity, sort of this mishmash, or was she on the door representing the things we just said?
She was, and what it represents is the incredible magnetism and cultural conservation that went on in the folk cultures, where they would not let go of their old venerations. And so sometimes you would have a freestanding Sheila who started out near a water course or a well, being brought into and being built into a wall or brought into a church in some ways. In other cases, quite clearly, the Shila was created and cut out of stone to fit into the church. In other words, she was made as a lintel. So she was created for the purpose of being added to the church. So this, to me, is one of the conditions of Christianization in Ireland, is that the clergy had to, in some way, accommodate the demands of the people. And this was one of the demands, that these beings, these ancestral forces or these land spirits or however you want to look at them, or even goddesses, were so strongly part of the culture that the church could not exist without them. And even that for people to be attracted into the church, they had to be present. And so that's something that happened. And there's a very fascinating book on this, and I'm trying to remember the woman's name. Her last name is Friday, on the Shila na gCaoimh, and she finally solved the puzzle of the name, because for like 150 years they've been going, well, what does this name mean? And she actually proved that the gCaoimh part of the name meant vulva.
Wow.
So and she also, pardon?
The Shila part. What is that?
Well, Shila is slang for a female. In the Gaelic speaking world, and Irish and probably Scottish too. So that part, and so it would be Shila or female of the cunt or girl of the cunt or whatever.
Can I
say that on this radio?
Well, you just did. well, you know, so then the stuff that I have read that say, you know, that this Christianized definition for what she was, that they were trying to discourage people from lust and temptation and sexuality. Is there any accuracy to that, or maybe that's a later belief?
Well, only in the sense, I think that's something later for sure, that might have been some way that it got turned. For example, you have figures known as Luxuria in some of the Romanesque churches on the continent, and it has a woman holding a serpent to her breast. Now, that archetype originates in the symbolism of the Earth Mother, and there are examples of Earth herself being shown in the early Christian period suckling snakes in ivory diptychs that were used as gospel covers. So very clearly seen as part of the sacred. But then Luxuria is this figure that arises. This is a Latin word meaning sensuality, essentially. And so then it becomes a cautionary image that in these churches as a negative figure of, you know, the overcoming of lust that has to happen according to church ideology. So you see all these shifts going on. And in the case of the Shilas, however, what happened is because they continued to be so closely related to the folk practices, including birthing rituals that women were doing, and Anne Friday talks about this in her book on the Shilas, the clergy, especially after the Catholic Reformation and the Council of Trent, they really cracked down on pagan practices, which had been necessary to bring people into the church, but enough time had gone by that they could now push it out and dispose of it. And so some were destroyed, many others were buried in the church crypt. And even today, like if you go, somebody was just telling me the museum at Dublin, they have Shilas, but they're very sequestered and hidden in the museum. You have to go in the basement and you have to go in a certain part in order to see them. So there is still this very squeamish way that they're treated, that, you know, we won't really want the children to be seeing those. And so,
thanks.
Well, and that's why I did this post, because we need another view of the female body other than the one that we've been given, which is something that is colonized, it's made into chattel, it's sold as porn in you know, ways that are behaviorally offensive and it's not the nudity that's offensive or the sexuality that's offensive, but it is the subordination and the violence and, you know, the coy. There's something fundamentally that's a lie at the base of it. There's a great line by Carolyn Gage where she says, pornography is the counterfeit of the sacred. And I think that's really true.
It is. That's a wonderful, wonderful quote. Well, here, shifting gears a little bit again, tell us about what's happening with, like, the Liberian women who organized against the warlords.
Well, they're still going. They still have they're having now meetings around national reorganization, and they're really taking the reins.
Give a tiny bit of backstory, and then bring Liz up to date.
Well, there's this great movie which you can get some clips on YouTube. Pray the Devil Back to Hell. And this group of women, the warlords were ravaging the country. There was all kinds of horrific sexual violence, killings, lootings going on. And the women gathered together, and they began sitting out in the fish market and protesting. And eventually they gathered so much momentum, they were able to force the ruling warlord to go to the peace talks, to the peace table in another country. And then the women followed them there and began pushing them there, because the men were feasting in the hotel and having a great time and negotiating over who would get what office and so forth. And the women then, again, they actually surrounded the hotel, and they wouldn't let anybody leave until they came up with a peace agreement. In the meantime, the ruling warlord was indicted in Sierra Leone and was forced to flee. And so then he was basically toppled from power, and then in short order, the women had gotten Ellen Johnson Sirleaf elected as the first female president of Liberia. But they are not sitting on their laurels. They are really engaged in actively seeing how they can create social transformation, and it really is based on public welfare as the basis of government. So it's a very inspiring story.
Now, why do you think they were able to be successful and it doesn't happen other places? Was it just the sheer tenacity of this particular group of women?
They did not give up, and I think that they were at a moment where it was ripe. It was ripe for that to happen. They had a lot of support because so many people were suffering and had horrific consequences of all these political things that were going on, and they could see clearly that the women were on the right track. They got a lot of support. I think here in this country we have a different situation because a lot of people don't know where their own interests lie. They fall for all of this crazy Fox News stuff where, they're being baited by red herrings, and they go, oh, okay, let's follow the herring over there, and they go stampeding off in the wrong direction. And so I think that education is really educating people about issues is really a key thing here, because where we are so dominated by the mass media. Their perception of reality is really warped by the fact that important major corporate powers are able to drive public opinion in the way that they do.
Yeah, it's pretty insane. Speaking of quotes, here's one for you. One of the new shows that I really like to watch is the United States of Tara, and her son was talking about freedom. Americans having freedom, and the quote went something like, "Yeah, Americans are free, even free to be stupid." And as soon as I heard that, they just caught me in the right mood, because I just got finished, telling somebody about the Fox News bubble that so many people live in, and you're so right. I wonder if we'll ever. You're talking about suppressed histories, and here we can't even get right what happened a year ago.
Exactly.
There's been,
that's true.
How can we possibly reclaim what happened thousands of years ago when, as we speak, history, last week's history is being rewritten from what really happened. It's just, it's just sheer insanity.
But we can, because these really are things that are not unknowable. They can be known. It's just that we have these forces trying to have squid ink around everything so nothing can be seen, But that's our work, is we have to bring some sort of clarity to all of this, because I think that there's been a lot of divisiveness, even just in the last half century, which has made people say, you have to pick. You can either fix things for women or you can fix things for people of color, ignoring that there's a large majority of the planet that actually falls into both of those categories.
Yeah, there's a bit of overlap there.
the political or the spiritual, this or that, is this dualism that keeps getting forced onto us like a grid is really damaging, because until we have an integrated view of everything that's going on and all the forces that are affecting us and the interrelated nature of the various oppressions that are in place, then we are going to be very successful at undoing it.
Absolutely. Well, Max, we have about 5 or 6 minutes left, and I'm going to throw it to you. What would you like to make sure listeners know before you have to leave us tonight?
Well, I want to make sure that people know about my website, www.presshistories.net, and you can just you can Google Suppress Histories if it doesn't come up. I mean, you know, the whole spelling thing and stuff. And so on there are articles. There's links to the new posters, Sacra Vulva and Female Icons. There's a gallery of images with short articles talking about the Libyan connection and rock art and a lot of different things. And then, of course, video clips of Women's Power and Global Perspective, which you can view either from my site or from YouTube. And there's a lot more on there. There's articles and a catalog of presentations and different things like that. So that's that part. I am going to be teaching a course starting by the end of June, Woman Shaman. And this is going to be my second online course. It's going to be very global in perspective. And we're going to look at both ancient and present day traditions of shamanic arts, medicine people, healers, diviners, drummers, ecstatic dance, all of those things. And so that's a different site, and that's going to be www.sourcememory.net. If you can't remember all of these, I'll have it all linked from Suppress Histories once I get ready to do that. And then the third site is my art site, which is www.maxbashu.net. And I've just put up some images from drawings I did in the early 70s that I'm calling the Shamanic Series. And so you can find that near the bottom of the main page at that Art by Max Dashu site. So those are some things that I wanted to mention.
Are you going to be appearing anywhere? Are you scheduled to do any presentations anywhere soon?
Next up, I'm going to be going to Germany for the Spiritual Politics Conference. It's being put on by Akademie Hagia. And then I'm going to be in Italy, in actually Rome and Bologna, which I don't have the actual info all together, but it will be on the events link at suppresshistories.net. And most of all, I'm going to be in Amsterdam and different parts of the Netherlands in early June. So that's the most upcoming things that I have happening. Nothing here in North America just yet for now. So those will be coming up, and as I say, go to the events page. You can see what's going on there. And then I'll be teaching the course starting this summer on Woman Shaman, which I'm very excited about.
The online course, I haven't actually attended one of those, so forgive me if this is a dumb question.
Not at all.
Is it all audio? I mean, is it just talking on the phone, or can you actually...
No. In fact, what we have a private discussion listserv where, you know, I post articles or article fragments, and then anybody can comment, they can ask questions, they can raise their own ideas about things. So there's like a big discussion board is basically what it is, that is in your time. In other words, you don't have to be online at that moment to comment. You can do it whenever you want. And then I also post web pages with images for our discussion. If enrollment goes up to a certain point, I also hold webinars that we will have live lectures using, you basically on your screen appears the images, and you can ask questions or, you know, participate in those. So there's a variety of different ways that I'm sharing information through the online courses. But thanks for asking that, actually.
Well, yeah, because you know, I figured there was a way to do it, and if there was, I figured you knew how. So, and you know, with your images being so wonderful, I just couldn't imagine you do a class without a way to show.
Absolutely not. I mean, yes, the images are really an important core of it. I consider the images as important as anything that's written, and in many cases more so, because in a great many cases, that's all we have is the archaeology.
Well, Max, I guess my final question for you would be, and maybe this is tough, so forgive me, but in all your years of doing this, and I want to thank you for the body of work you've compiled so that we all have it, and none of us should take it for granted. Has there been any one thing that you ran across that was the most profound?
It's really hard to pick one, but I do have something here I wanted to share with you. Because
okay.
I think this says a lot, and this is a Sweat Lodge invocation of Aztec priestesses to the Temezcaltesi, which means the grandmother of the sweat bath. And so this kind of brings it all together because it does speak to the priestess. It speaks to a really important healing goddess tradition and also to the survival of these ways inside the Mexican world in the post-conquest period. And this
and
was written down
from
Nahuatl.
Where does this what? Come from? How was it used?
Okay, it was used as an invocation entering into the sweat lodge, because just like in North America, the Central Americans also had sweat houses that they used in as a sacrament, basically. And so I think that this is one of many. I mean, I could name the Maori creation chant. There's so many beautiful scriptures, the chapters of coming forth by day that the ancient Kemetic people had in ancient Egypt. But this is just what I happen to have in front of me. So since you asked that, I'm gonna just read it to you. Okay?
Please. Yes.
Mother of the gods and us all, whose creative and life-giving power shone in the Temezcalli, also named the place of flowers. The place where she sees sacred things, sets to right what has been deranged in human bodies, makes young and tender things growing and strong, and where she aids and cures. So that's the sweat lodge.
That's lovely. Yeah, because the sweat lodges are a place to go for healing. I mean, I know a woman who claims she went in a sweat lodge and with breast cancer and was cured. I mean, I know that
yeah.
might sound extreme, but...
I believe her. You know,
yeah.
it cures and it also gives insight, it gives vision. It is something that illuminates. There's just so many different, it puts, like it says, what has been deranged in human bodies. So often we're thrown off by worry, stress, anxiety, fear, doubt, so many things. And it's just like, just to get everything back into harmony, you know,
right,
and
right.
through basic contact with the earth, and the elements in an intentional way, and amazing what can be achieved when we're able to do that.
Well, thank you for reminding us of that and sharing that, and for coming back to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where you're always welcome.
Thanks, Karen. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Well, good night, Max. And
good night.
Have safe travels, and I hope you hit lots of wonderful museums and all those wonderful European cities you're headed to.
I hope so. Thanks.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, listeners, if you're just tuning in for some reason, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, and I hope you didn't miss that wonderful conversation with Max Max Dashu, D-A-S-H-U, because she's celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Suppressed Histories Archives, and certainly offering us some great research there at her site, and of uncovering that which patriarchy would rather stay swept beneath the patriarchal rug. So thank you very much, Max. Thank you very much. Well, we are going to just take our quick break here because we are at the crossing the thresholds into the bottom of the hour. And for 1 minute, I am going to leave you as I prepare for our What's the Buzz segment. And what I'm going to do is give you tonight's What's the Buzz. And if there's time, because I promised I would, I'll give you what you missed from Monday when we had those technical difficulties. So for this minute, I'm going to leave you listening for 60 seconds to a snippet of Jenna Green's The Bard song.
We honor now the Celtic bard, we offer up our praise. Guardians of our mysteries, keepers of the old days. We honor the bard, the
back with you. Thanks for staying tuned in. Well, do you hear that, listeners? You know what that sound means. It means it's time for What's the Buzz, the segment when I tell you about the bees buzzing around in my bonnet all week. And these were the bees that were buzzing around in my bonnet just recently when we were away in Washington. There was so much in the news, and I wasn't with you, so I made notes and to make sure I took it back home and shared it with you. I kept saying to Roy, if there was a show this Wednesday, I'd have had this and that and the other thing to say on What's the Buzz. So, like I said, I made a list and just want to make sure they're in your psyche in case you hear something about this in the coming days and weeks and months ahead. First, what I think was important to mention was there was the Nebraska governor who signed an anti-abortion law for his state using bad science, saying that a fetus feels pain when there is no science to actually support this. And I think there's also some constitutionality issues there. I'm not sure a state can actually sign a law that doesn't go along with federal law. I think federal actually trumps state law. So it was probably unconstitutional as well as bad science and going against abortion legalities in the United States. But I'll give you a follow-up if I hear anything about what the pro-choice folks are doing about this. Because let's remember, abortion is legal in this country, even though in some areas law enforcement can't even be counted on to protect the safety and health of women's reproductive health care providers, which is really, really a shame. Then we learn that the Republicans, or the GOP as they're called, get their talking points from this guy by the last name of Lutz. You ever wonder why they all parrot the same distortions and lies like their broken record? Never mind what's true, so Americans can make an informed decision. Their agenda is to get back in power no matter what the cost. And we all saw how good things were those 8 years under Bush, right? Like, we need that again. I hope people's memories are not so short. And remember, Fox News, a propaganda arm of the Republican Party, though some say the tail's now wagging the dog, will say anything to get the Republicans back in power. They'll use fear, lies, absolutely anything. As Max and I were just saying, the Republican bubble, so many people, the Fox bubble, so many people are just really uninformed and they're being manipulated by lies and fear. I really believe President Obama could declare apple pie and ice cream the official American dessert and they'd find a problem with it. And in my mind, these lies, distortions, and deceptions are really akin to treason. You know, damn freedom of speech. When you dupe an uninformed electorate so you benefit yourself, because let's face it, the GOP is only worried about benefiting corporations who pad their pockets and war chests. You know, there's something fundamentally wrong there when you use the freedom of speech to manipulate the population. There's no integrity. There's no honesty. They can't be trusted. My mantra has become, how do you know a Republican is lying? His mouth is moving. I mean, maybe it's not original, but I feel like it's, at least to me, it's true. Then let's not forget the Republican governor of Virginia. He's called the new blood of the GOP, and he's considered a GOP hopeful for leadership, maybe even a potential candidate for 2012 for the presidency. Well, he continued his racial, sexist, and homophobic gaffes. The latest was requiring a literacy test for felons released from jail to see if they'd qualify to vote when they were back in society. Well, let's think about that for a minute. The preponderance of people in jail, I mean, I think statistics bear this out, black folks who will probably vote Democrat. So the more Democrats you can get not to vote, the better it is for the GOP. So you see the reasoning there? He also passed legislation that he had to backpedal on that took protections away from gay Americans, and he declared April Confederacy Awareness Month without the mention of the horrors of slavery. This was the guy who stated in his college dissertation women shouldn't be in the workplace and had equally egregious things to say about people living together without being being married in gays and lesbians. This guy is just a throwback to white male supremacists or the Confederate South. It's just, you know, I don't know how else to describe it. It's all about white male supremacy and to hell with everything else. Well, let's hope the aware and more tolerant voters of Virginia who care about social justice can get rid of this guy, their governor, and get rid of him quick so they have a more evolved governor in office. Then Ron Paul, who might run for president in 2010 for the Republican Party, came out and tried to put the kibosh on all the other Republicans calling Obama a socialist. In a rare moment of GOP honesty, he said it's more accurate to say Obama is a corporatist. Certainly not good for progressives or liberals, but at least it moves away from this stupid and inaccurate socialist lie that's been perpetuated by most GOP people and Fox. But did Ron Paul's honesty stop the lies from coming out of the GOP camp? Nope, because it riles people up who don't know what advantages some aspects of socialism might actually bring American labor in this country. You know, socialism's become a bad word, but there's, you know, quite a number of benefits for people in a socialist country. You know, I wish they'd do a little homework or get some friends overseas or get out of the United States and see some of these advantages instead of making it this dirty word. I mean, for instance, how does 4 weeks vacation every year sound to you? Not too bad, huh? And what about if you had a baby, you get a year off with pay? Now, talk about family values. I mean, those are some family values that Republicans ought to be pushing instead of the kind of family values that they want to push that take other people's rights away. Or not letting corporations exploit Americans, as the GOP is so fond of doing. Then there's Sarah Palin, the woman I love to hate. She earned $12 million just this past year, and it's only April. Pretty clear now why the former governor quit her public service job, eh? She's about serving herself, not the American people, especially with all her lies and divisiveness that just rile people up, get them agitated, encouraging them to reload. Say what she wants, that's code, and it gives crazies or people on the fringe just a license to do harm. And she's also out there trying to delegitimize the Obama administration as well. Another right-wing nut job, Mike Huckabee, who might run for president in 2012 also, went at it with a New Jersey college journalist. Well, Huckabee in an interview compared being gay to people on drugs or people practicing incest or polygamy. Well, so far Huckabee has embarrassed himself and has had to backpedal from all these ignorant statements, reminding me a lot of a comedian who said of fundamentalists, a lot of damn and not a lot of mental. Next thing I was taking notes about was Politico found out that the Tea Party Express was a con game to make money off teabaggers with the support of Fox News, who were behind their scheme. And let's not forget, without the propaganda machine of Fox, because I won't call them a news outlet or journalists, and the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine, if that hadn't been repealed, the teabaggers wouldn't even exist, and the GOP wouldn't have been so successful at misinforming everyone about health care and getting the bill so watered down. I mean, that's why most of the people in the United States, statistics show, I think 52% were against it, because they really didn't know what it was in it, because they had been lied to so much by so many people who had an agenda to be against the bill because they were being paid by the healthcare industry. It's just that simple. The healthcare industry was the one that was bankrolling those marches for the teabaggers. And I'm not even sure the teabaggers knew who was footing the bill. So here the people were voting against, you know, issues of social justice, maybe in a lot of cases even voting against their own economic interests, and they didn't even know. But that's what happens when all you do is listen to Fox News. So, and then I think the last thing that really got to me was a book that was in the news that everybody was so excited about. It was called Get Rich Cheating. Get Rich Cheating. I thought, what a great role model for people and kids everywhere. And most journalists talking about it were jumping on the cheating bandwagon. You know, how can they follow these cheating games? Get rich, just don't get caught. I just don't know sometimes. Well, let me go ahead and cover some of the What's the Buzz items that we didn't get to on Monday because of our technical difficulties, because we do have some time. The first one was from the Ms. blog, and it was a wonderful title. It said, Stevens Steps Down, they're talking about Supreme Court Justice Stevens, and White Men Clutch Their Pearls. Pretty cool, right? Well, Justice John Paul Stevens announced recently he intends to step down from the bench of the U.S. Supreme Court, and the belly aching began almost immediately. The whole notion that white men need not apply for the soon-to-be-open seat caused cries of radicalism, presumably because a person of color or a woman in a position of power unbalances the notion that white men are the preordained natural rulers of all they survey. Well, judging from the racist and sexist attacks that Justice Sonia Sotomayor underwent during her confirmation process, should President Obama dare to once again pick someone for the U.S. Supreme Court who is not white and male, the new nominee will certainly undergo attack. I mean, they're already talking about starting the attack, and they don't even know who he's going to nominate. You know, in this so-called post-racial world, we don't see racism unless white men feel their privilege is being challenged. And then it becomes reverse racism, because that's the only kind of marginalization that counts, at least to them, even if it's only a figment of their imagination. To date, just so you'll know, there have only been three women on the U.S. Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Sotomayor, only the last being a woman of color. There have been two African-American men, Thurgood Marshall and Clarence Thomas, and then there have been 106 white men. If white men are looking for affirmative action in this situation, it's only because they want to stake a claim of ownership over the Supreme Court. Of course, they believe they're the best for the job because they want the law to be interpreted only through their experience and their privilege and for their benefit. When Sonia Sotomayor commented, quote, I would hope that a wise Latina woman with the richness of her experiences would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life, unquote, white men were quick to protest her own neutrality. If this were, in fact, the truth, the world would not reflect their biases and needs. Glenn Beck on Fox quickly labeled Sotomayor a racist who was not that bright and divisive, while Rush Limbaugh said this about Sonia Sotomayor. So here you have a racist. You might want to soften that. You might want to say reverse racist. And the libs, of course, say the minorities cannot be racist because they don't have the power to implement their racism. Well, those days are gone because reverse racists certainly do have the power to implement their power. Obama is the greatest living example of a reverse racist, and now he's appointed one. White male conservatives would like us to believe that simply because a few people of color hold positions of power, the balance has shifted, when nothing could be further from the truth. People of color in these positions are a symbol that we have undergone some change, but a complete metamorphosis has not occurred, and in fact, that is what the rage and loud outbursts of the conservatives are attempting to quash. Glenn Beck suggests that Obama will try to find a gay, handicapped black woman who is an immigrant, who is radical, just like Sotomayor. To that, I say, yes, please. The Supreme Court should be an accurate reflection of the population and not a platform to actively promote white male supremacy. Do I hear you cheering out there? Okay, the other item I wanted to share with you is also from the Ms. blog, and it says, unfortunately, that Japan drops in global sex equality rankings. 8 months After 8 months of working in Japan, the author of this column says she sees why women colleagues are relegated to tea service during meetings, and it's disappointing to discover that workplace sexism isn't limited to small rural towns in Japan. New data shows that Japan ranks lower in economic gender equality than any G7 nation. The World Economic Forum recently amended Japan's rating in 2009, dropping the country 26 places from 75th to 101st out of 134 nations. The revision came after a Japanese activist group called the Working Women's Network contested the initial findings, which implied gains in gender equality since 2008, but it wasn't in fact true. With the adjustments, it's clear that employment sex disparity has worsened since 2006, when Japan ranked 80th among 115 nations. The 2009 drop to 101st represented a staggering 17.3% decline in rank in just 3 years. The inequality is especially pronounced in the economic and political sectors, where women make up only 9% of female legislators, senior officials, and managers. In November 2009, shortly after the report's release, the Secretary General Angel Gurria gave a speech in Japan encouraging a proactive emphasis on utilizing women in the workforce. She said, "Japan is the only OECD country, along with Korea, where the labor force participation rate of women with a university education is roughly the same as for those without an upper secondary education. Moreover, many women who do not work are only part-time employees. In short, Japan is underutilizing the talents of its female population." Not good. It may be easy for the Japanese government to dismiss the revised drop in global sex equality because the disparity clearly hasn't affected Japan's standing as the world's largest second economy. I can't see Japan getting too upset over those statistics, unfortunately. Let's see. Let's talk about Sarah Palin. This article comes from Sharon Moore, and it was on the Huffington Post, and it's called Palin's Pinnacle of Hypocrisy. You might know that Sarah Palin took the stand Friday in the trial of former University of Tennessee student David Kernel. Kernel's charged with hacking Palin's Yahoo email account when Palin was campaigning with McCain in the 2008 presidential campaign. Well, Kernel is facing 50 years in prison over this incident. This young man would be 72 years old when he gets out of prison. According to the Anchorage Daily News, Palin was asked if she thought the charges against Kernel were excessive. And here's what Palin said, quote, "I don't know, but I do think there should be consequences for bad behavior," unquote. Well, Sharon Moore, the author of the article, says, consequences for bad behavior, eh? Well, here's a reminder about some of Sarah Palin's behavior. This is coming from the quitter governor of Alaska, who used state resources to relentlessly pursue a family vendetta. Bed. To her kids at state expense on official state of Alaska business trips. Lashed out at socialized death panel health care while her family was covered by socialized death panel health care. She enjoyed socialized health care in Canada when she was growing up and needed it. She's had health care provided to her grandson through the Indian Health Services. She advocates abstinence when it never worked for her own family. And family members ignored subpoenas and were found in contempt. And the list goes on and on and on and on and on. I'd like to say, what about that $12 million you've made already, and it was supposed to be to help other candidates? And of that $12 million, I think the article that did the research showed that she's only given about $7,500 to candidates. So I think it's pretty clear that Ms. Palin is looking to take care of herself rather than be a public servant, and that's okay, but at least be honest about it. Let's see what else. Why We Still Blame Victims of Rape. There's some important things in here, and we should be aware of it. This comes from the Alternet blog, one of the places I get my information, and the author of the article was Ellen Fredericks, Why We Still Blame Rape Victims. Well, earlier this year, you might have noticed Christina Keegan, because she's also known as Miss Nevada. She announced that the issue she chose to champion as her platform for the 2010 Miss America competition would be rape education and recovery. And that's because Keegan, a 24-year-old medical student, picked the topic because a few years ago she was date raped by an acquaintance. And in many ways, her choice of platform reflects the fact that the treatment of rape is different today than it was 20 years ago. Back then, the concept of date rape was a new one, and rape victims could expect to be scrutinized harshly. Yet our understanding of the crime of rape remains flawed, including those involved in the legal system. For many people, a stranger in a dark alley is sort of the symbol of rape. That's who you think of when you hear rape. Yet the director of the Rape Abuse Incest National Network hotline explains that in the United States, 73% of victims know their attacker. This message hasn't completely resonated, and as a result, if a woman's rape doesn't fit into the expected model, her story might get questioned, and if her own choices and character are questionable, well, she might be raked over the coals. So the victim blaming in general is still alive and well, and it's more confusing because so many of the rapes are date rapes and not back alley rape. One survey conducted with 100 people in the United Kingdom, Britain, found that while both men and women tend to blame female rape victims for sexual assault, women are actually less forgiving than men. Among other things, the survey indicated was that 71% of women and 51% of men believed a woman should accept responsibility for unwanted sex after getting into bed with someone. Another 31% of women and 23% of men thought women were to blame for rape if they had dressed provocatively. Of all respondents, over half thought there were some circumstances where a victim should accept responsibility for the rape. Then a different study conducted by researchers out of the University of Central Lancashire found that men are more likely than women to blame male victims of rape for not fighting off their attacker. Blaming the victim isn't unique to rape. Indeed, the actions of people who are sick, poor, or unemployed are often questioned as well. But the ways in which we blame rape victims, the majority of whom are women, are different. Sometimes this blame is subtle, other times not so much. For instance, leaflets were handed out to random women by members of a Christian group in Virginia last month. The pamphlets were titled Women and Girls. Scripture tells us that when a man looks on a woman to lust for her, he has already committed adultery in his heart. If you are dressed in a way that tempts men to do this secret or not so secret sin, you are a participant in the sin. By the way, some rape victims would not have been raped if they had dressed properly. So can we really say they were innocent victims? Thank you, church group from Virginia. Clearly, this is a fringe group, but street corner proselytizers aren't alone in believing myths about rape. A lot of people scrutinize everything about the rape victim, how she was dressed, how she acted, how much she drank, previous sexual partners, where she was, why she was there. And it isn't only the actions of a victim that are questioned. Some of the most common rape myths are actually about rapists. Let's see. As Jen Wilson of RAIN says, one of them, again, is that you'll be attacked by a stranger and that the likelihood of that is greater than being attacked by someone you know. Another study done by researchers in Israel found that people blame rape victims in order to maintain a sense of control over their own lives. Interesting. So anyway, they bring the point up that if Christina Keegan, who had been raped, wasn't a medical student, if she wasn't someone who was in the Miss America competition, how would she have been treated if, say, for instance, she had been a dancer working late or a party girl or a longtime wife of the perpetrator instead of this wholesome all-American beauty pageant contestant? Would she have been treated like the victim? Or, would she have been treated as if it were her own fault? So just some food for thought. The writer of the column, Ellen Fredericks, is a sex educator in New York City, where she teaches high school and college classes. So more things have to change still. I want to go to France. I want to move to Paris. If I could speak French, if I wasn't already the age I am and so settled, that's where I would go. And another thing just came down the pike this week that to make me feel that way even more. French President Nicolas Sarkozy has ordered legislation that would ban women from wearing Islamic veils that fully cover the face and body in public places. It's Sarkozy's first political action toward an outright ban, though he said repeatedly that such outfits oppress women and are not welcome in France, home to a firmly secular government. He said a burqa is a statement, not a dress. He said France is an egalitarian, secular country. So get with the culture and the program where you live. That's what you have to do if you live in France. And I wish some of the conservatives in our country would take a page out of his book, but I'm sure they're still protesting French fries because Bill O'Reilly told them to. Also, Quebec is doing the same thing. They are about to, if they haven't already, ban the burqa because they also see it as a symbol of oppression for women. Let's see. There's a new abortion bill in Oklahoma, and I think you probably want to know about this. It's kind of shocking. This comes from Grace Huang, and it was on the Alternate blog. Shocking new abortion bill requires vaginal probe ultrasound and collection of women's private data. Well, we know what that's about. That's just to discourage women from getting abortions. But here's a little bit more detail because you ask. The Oklahoma Senate passed 5 abortion bills Monday night of this week, which opponents have said will severely limit a woman's ability to get an abortion and would entail some of the strictest anti-abortion measures in the country. One of the bills would force a woman to get an ultrasound at least 1 hour prior to an abortion and be shown the image and given a detailed explanation, even if she wishes otherwise. A vaginal probe would be used if it would provide a clear image of the fetus, which no other state requires. 3 others do require ultrasounds, but none force the women to listen to the explanation of what she's seeing in the ultrasound. State Senator Anthony Sykes, Republican, the bill's sponsor, said the measure was designed to provide women with additional information before having an abortion. Sure. Other pieces of legislation also require clinics that perform abortion to post signs stating it's against the law for anyone to force you to have an abortion. Forbid state exchange program insurance from covering abortion and prevent wrongful life and wrongful birth lawsuits. One last bill would require the woman to first answer a lengthy questionnaire and provide information such as her age, marital status, race, education, and reason for seeking the abortion. The doctor would then report this information without the patient's name attached, which would be compiled and put on a state website and accessible by government personnel. The bill's sponsor said this would provide valuable information on who seeks abortions and why, in addition to helping create programs aimed at preventing abortions. Opponents of the bill, however, argue that this represents an unconstitutional invasion of privacy. And it's pretty clear these bills are just trying to prevent women in Oklahoma from access to health care and making it more difficult for physicians to provide that care. They disregard patient privacy and medical standards and are poor public health policy. Not to mention, you sort of get the feeling that they look at women's wombs as just some incubator, and the woman has no rights to what's going to happen with her body. Makes my hair light on fire. Couple last things, and we're almost done with What's the Buzz. This next article I think is important. The Tea Party crowd needs to wake up to who the real villains are. Well, I've been saying that for a while, but now someone with some stature, Bill Moyers, is also saying it. In his article, he says, with all due respect, we can only wish those Tea Party activists who gathered in Washington and other cities this week weren't so single-minded about just who's responsible for their troubles, real and imagined. They're up in arms against big government, especially the Obama administration. If they thought this through, they'd be joining forces with other grassroots Americans who in the coming weeks will be demonstrating in Washington and other cities against high finance, taking on Wall Street and the country's biggest banks. Because remember, the original Tea Party wasn't directed just against the British Redcoats. It was about a monopoly over trade, including tea, of the East West India Company. So it was about busting monopolies. That's not what these tea baggers are about. It may seem a bit of a stretch from tea to credit default swaps, but the principle is the same. When enormous private wealth goes unchecked, regular folks get hurt badly. That's what happened in 2008 when the moneyed interests led us up the garden path to the great collapse. And even today, you can turn on the news and see that the GOP, the Republicans, are resisting reform of Wall Street. Therefore, the people with enormous private wealth, they're not for you and I. And people really have to start looking at that if they think otherwise. So anyway, the Tea Party crowd should be demanding accountability from people like Bank of America, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Chase, Wells Fargo, scores of hedge funds and private equity firms that constitute what we loosely call Wall Street. But are the culprits taking responsibility for devastating the lives of millions of ordinary Americans? Nope. Nope, all you had to do was turn on the news last night, and you'd see that they were saying all sorts of things, but nothing remotely related to it was their fault. So, and we also see the GOP SWAT team, also known as the United States Chamber of Commerce, has already spent $3 million to try to kill or cripple key reform, including the proposed new Consumer Financial Protection Agency. That Consumer Financial Protection Agency would protect you and me from predators on Wall Street. But the chamber, they only care about the corporations. Corporations have bankrolled ads that make it seem like the Red Army is at our doorstep. Let's see. Some final thoughts here. The Tea Party people might also want to watch something besides Fox News so that they realize who was bankrolling all the fear about the health care reform. I touched on that a little bit earlier. Maybe they get a barometer check if they look at maybe The Nation magazine or maybe if they turned on MSNBC. And I wonder, too, these teabaggers, they are talking about they don't want big government, okay? But again, check how, they're siding with this immigration law that they just passed in Arizona. They really look like racists and hypocrites, saying they want smaller government, less government interference in people's lives, yet they are supporting people having to carry papers to prove they're citizens. It smacks of all those old movies about the Gestapo to me. And, while I'm talking Tea Party and their beliefs, what's this woman in Arizona saying about health care reform? Bring your doctor a chicken for payment? She's the GOP Tea Party candidate that's running against the Democrat Harry Reid. Wish I were kidding. I'd like to see her try to take a chicken to her doctor and trade it for a mammogram. And, okay, we're getting to the final thing I wanted to share with you, and it's called the virginity industry. Kind of interesting, huh? The virginity industry. Well, this comes from the BBC News. And young Arab women wait in an upmarket medical clinic for an operation that will not only change their lives, but quite possibly save it. But not how you think. The operation is a matter of choice and not necessity. It costs about 2,000 euros or 1,700 pounds and carries very little risk. The clinic is not in Dubai or Cairo, but in Paris, and the surgery they're waiting for is to restore their virginity. their hymen. Remember that thing that breaks first time you have intercourse? Whether in Asia or the Arab world, an unknown number of women face an agonizing problem having broken a deep taboo. They've had sex outside of marriage and, if found out, risk being ostracized by their communities or even murdered. Did you hear that? They risk not only being ostracized, but even murdered. Now more and more of them are undergoing surgery to reconnect their hymens and hide any sign of past sexual activity. They want to ensure that blood is spilled on their wedding night sheets. Something very, very wrong here, ladies. Seriously, something very, very wrong. And I don't know. I guess I'll close with this quote. I thank Duncan for sending it to me. We were talking politics on Facebook, talking about conservatives and liberals and Democrats and Republicans, and he sent me this relevant quote, and it goes like this. The quote is from John Kenneth Galbraith, and it's, quote, "The modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy. That is the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness." Can't say that I don't agree. Well, listeners, as long as you keep telling me you think this was the Buzz segment is important, I'll keep shedding light on ideals of the sacred feminine, which are being honored out in the world, or ideals that are being oppressed. We have to be aware. We have to keep pushing back. Greed and the desire for power over others is pervasive. People who measure themselves and their value by the size of their bank book aren't going to roll over and give up their influence and control. We have to counter their toxic strategies and the imbalance and disharmony they create. And one way we do that is simply by being aware. And if we're aware, we can make sure we don't vote for people who will throw us under the bus. And remember, and maybe you're tired of hearing me say it, I don't know, but I think it deserves a bumper sticker. According to the Dalai Lama, it will be Western women who will save the world. That means you and me and our like-minded brothers, and we will. We'll do it with our thoughts, our words, and ideas, our deeds. Our thoughts, our words, and our deeds. As we will it, so shall it be. So, with that being said, the bees are released from my bonnet for another week. After tonight's show, I just want to suggest that maybe if you're in Orange County, you can drop by the Artists United for Social Justice benefit at Bistango's. They're working to stop human trafficking, and they do humanitarian relief, bringing in medical supplies to Haitian clinics. Bistango's is at 19100 Von Carmen in Irvine, and the Artists United for Social Justice will be there till 10 o'clock tonight. And Bistango's is going to donate 50% of the evening's proceeds to the mission in Haiti to help stop the enslavement of women and children and bring some relief. So that's Bistango's on Von Carmen and Irvine. Also, I am planning a sacred tour for women and men to Goddess Sites of Turkey for October 2011, so stay tuned and keep up with the developments on my website. This journey, my third, is intended to be a very experiential journey, complete with hamams, which are what you call Turkish baths, that will help us really get into our bodies and experience the magic and the culture of Turkey. We'll do dream journals and meditations and rituals at the sacred sites. We'll visit wonderful archaeological sites and museums, places like Shetel Hayuk, where we believe egalitarian societies and people who honored gender partnership lived and worshiped goddess. And I'm only planning to take about 20 men and women, so be thinking if you want to be one of our pilgrimage group. And speaking of Turkey, if you're in the Los Angeles or Southern California area, or actually in Irvine again, to be exact, on May 6th through 9th, one weekend only, there is the Anatolian Cultures and Food Festival at the Orange County Great Park in Irvine. It'll be a great warm-up to taking the tour. Roy and I went last year, and there were some arts and crafts from some Turkish college students who were raising money for school, just beautiful stuff at really, really reasonable prices. There was food and entertainment. Anyway, we attended last year, and it was really great, and I think it would be wonderful, especially for someone who hasn't had a chance to experience the history, food, and culture of Turkey yet. So I highly recommend that if you're looking for something interesting to do. That's the weekend of May 6th through 9th, the Anatolian Cultures and Food Festival. You can easily Google it. And speaking of pilgrimage, I've been invited to give a workshop at her church, the Feminist Lutheran Church in San Francisco, on May 16th. So if you're in the Bay Area, please come. Part of the workshop is on the art of pilgrimage and the esoterica of sacred sites of goddess. It's going to be a workshop for both your left and right brain, I promise. And because my motto, Have Sistrum Will Travel, is always my motto, I'm available to talk to your group or church if you'd like to sponsor me to come to your city. So keep me in mind. You can check out my website for all the various subjects I'm available to give talks on. And Capes for the Queen of Heaven for women only are starting back for session 2 on May 8th at the Goddess Temple of Orange County in Irvine. Yours truly is the teacher, and I've been having great fun with it. These next 6 classes, which can be taken individually, it's not necessary to take them all. We'll cover the description here. We'll discover female imagery and presence ignored in Judaism and Christianity, looking at the painful suppression of female experience in Western religious tradition, relating our personal discoveries and experience to our individual identities, exploring the new worldview and a theology for the future. Well, what all of that actually means is May 8th, we're going to be talking about the Hebrew goddess, how language symbols have erased female presence in the biblical tradition. May 22nd, we're going to talk about Sarah the priestess, ways to give voice to the women of the biblical tradition. June 12th, the Apostle Mary, Mary Magdalene as an apostle, and Joan Norton, who wrote the book The Mary Magdalene Within and who's been here on the Voice of the Sacred Feminine several times. She's going to co-teach that with me. June 26th is the Virgin Mary, and that's going to be about the nature of the image that's been created of Mary and the effects that image has on women today. July 10th, the session is on witchcraft and the burning times. July 24th is intentions, the new worldview that has emerged in recent decades, and our hopes for ourselves and our institutions and society for the future. And at the end of that day, we have a temple graduation party celebrating the completion of this stage of our sacred educations. So please, if you need any further information, you can get in touch with me. Classes are $25 each. They're participatory. We use ceremony and ritual, discussion, meditations, and PowerPoint presentations to teach the material. And if you're interested in these classes, either online or haven't been able to make them down in Irvine because it wasn't convenient, but you could attend classes in Venice Beach on the west side of L.A. in the fall, please contact me. These classes in Venice will be open to men and women. So if Venice is a more convenient location for you and you'd like to take these Cakes for the Queen of Heaven theology classes, they've been lots of fun. Women have said they've changed their lives, and they're already shifting their consciousness. Please get in touch with me. Classes are forming for the fall. I'd like you to know that one of the foremothers who's been on the show, and she's beloved by many of us, we have her books on our shelves, the Barbara G. Walker. She is the author of the Women's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets. That's probably what you might recognize easiest. Well, she has a new book out called Man-Made God, Man-Made God. And it's a series of articles by Barbara Walker. And let's see what it says. In this remarkable collection, Walker turns a critical eye toward religion as a business, religion's effects on children, the Bible as a moral guide and history, biblical infallibility, the doctrine of original sin, God as Father, the Bible of attitudes toward sex, church doctrine regarding women, church history vis-a-vis the Dark Ages, the Inquisition, and a book in witch burning, Christian afterlife traditions, traditional Christian origins, and more. So Stellar House Publishing puts this out, so you might want to take a look, maybe pick it up. It is called Man Made God by Barbara Walker. And let's see, there are some classes coming up in Studio City you might want to know about, Dancing the Goddess Within. Weekly classes are starting in the San Fernando Valley. Moving into feminine knowledge through sacred meditative movement, you'll transform into your goddess self. The classes include tantric yogic breathing, belly dance instruction, goddess wisdom teaching, focused intention, guided journeys, meditative creative dances. The teacher is Shakti. I know her well, and she's a great teacher. I've studied with her in the past. She's been developing goddess dance for over 10 years, teaching workshops and counseling. She's also a certified clinical hypnotherapist. So if you're interested in these classes, you can reach her at 818-509-9837. That's 818-509-9837. And her email address, shaktistore@aol.com. Shaktistore, S-H-A-K-T-I-S-T-A-R, at aol.com. Still a little bit time left till May 9th. You can go to the Craft and Folk Art Museum on Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles and see The Fool's Journey, The History and Symbolism of the Tarot. Museum hours are Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 to 5, Thursday, 11 to 7, Saturday and Sunday, 12 to 6. So that's the Craft and Folk Art Museum. Their website is CAFAM.org, CAFAM.org. Also, too, the Getty Museum has an exhibit called The Aztec Pantheon and the Art of Empire running through July 5th. And from the description, they're having works on display from the National Museum of Anthropology and excavations from Templo Mayor and Mexico City. Birth. Both should include goddess artifacts, I'm sure, so you might want to definitely check it out. Now, our lineup of guests for the rest of April. Let's see. Next week, actually, oops, we're done. We're done with April now. That's right. We certainly are. Next week will be May, and it is our Mother's Day special. And we're going to have screenwriter Esther Luttrell on the show. She is the author of Dear Dean, Love Mom. And she's going to be discussing her experiences discovering life on the other side after her son's death. You don't want to miss this show. I really thoroughly enjoyed Esther's book, and I think she has important things that we need to hear, whether they're coming from Esther or they're coming through the great she using Esther's voice. Definitely somebody we want to listen to about what she's discovered about life on the other side. Then on May 12th, calling in from England, we have Mary Sherratt. She's the author of Daughters of Witching Hill. We're going to discuss the women who inspired this piece of historical fiction. Then May 19th, we have a longtime teacher within the women's spirituality movement, Vajrama. She's the foundress of the Women's Mysteries of the Ancient Future Sisterhood, and we're going to discuss women's natural spiritual authority. And to close off May, on the 26th, producer Roberta Canto is discussing her three-part documentary, Blood Time, Moon Time, Dream Time. And I have to say, I saw this, and I definitely believe it's an important resource for women and men everywhere to help us reclaim life passage rituals and the power and sacredness of our bodies, and especially for women, our sacred bloods. So, well, that's about everybody else. Now, a little bit about me. I am an open book. You can literally go to my website at KarenTate.com and find out just about everything there is to know about me. I have YouTube clips there of talks I've given, Sacred Feminine for a Sustainable Future, the Isis Temple of Thanksgiving, Sekhmet's Mountain Sanctuary. There's 2 years of archive radio shows that people are calling a treasure, so please take advantage of it. They're free. Listen when you can. You can go to my Examiner column and see what's there. Some of my favorite articles are about Jimmy Carter and Michael Moore and Bill Clinton and dumbing down of America, all different things like that. I don't shy away from politics. I often talk about the politics of spirituality, from healthcare to sexism, and the inhumanity of political platforms that put profits before people. And let's see what else. And my two books. How could I forget my two books? I have a special for listeners and people who visit my website. Both of my books, you can get them cheaper from me directly than from Amazon. Both books are two for $25. My first book, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations. It's great whether you are an armchair or actual traveler. People have told me that I really helped them feel like they were actually there. If you never intend to leave that comfy armchair, or if you are an actual traveler, I actually tell you how to get to these places. And I hope I don't sound like I'm tooting my horn too much to say that I think this is the only book out there like this. You can find books on sacred places, but you will not find such a comprehensive book on goddess sacred sites around the entire world, more than 108 destinations in the book. All right. Well, just another reminder, if you can't listen live or you don't want to be on the air, you can always email me some of your questions. I thank those of you who have sent in show ideas. In fact, Sintra sent in a wonderful show idea to do a segment on sex and God and goddess, and I am actually going to be doing that in September. I've already lined up the guest. So I do listen, as I'm sure some of you already know, because I've taken your suggestions before, and I will continue to try to do what it is you enjoy. Well, that's the sign that the show is about to come to a close for another week, and I have a wonderful evening prayer for you tonight. It's the prayer of Lucius Apuleius to Isis, the great goddess. So I invite you to close your eyes and take a deep breath with me. Sort of bring yourself to a deeper focus as you listen to these lovely words. Holiest of the holy, perpetual comfort of mankind, you whose bountiful grace nourishes the whole world, whose heart turns towards all those in sorrow and tribulation as a mother's to her children. You who take no rest by night, no rest by day, but are always at hand to succor the distressed by land and sea, dispersing the gales that beat upon them. Your hand alone can disentangle the hopelessly knotted skeins of fate, terminate every spell of bad weather, and restrain the stars from harmful conjunction. The gods above adore you. The gods below do homage to you. You set the orb of heaven spinning round the poles. You give light to the sun. You govern the universe. You trample down the powers of Hades. At your voice, the stars move and the seasons recur. The spirits of earth rejoice. The elements obey. At your nod, the winds blow. Clouds drop wholesome rain upon the earth. Seeds quicken. Buds swell. Birds that fly through the air, breaths that prowl on the mountains, serpents that lurk in the dust, all these tremble in a single awe of you. My eloquence is unequal to praising you as you deserve, my wealth to providing you with all the offerings I have promised, my voice to uttering all the words which could celebrate your magnificence. No, not even if I had 1,000 tongues and 1,000 mouths and could speak forever. Nevertheless, poor as I am, I will do as much as I can in my devotion to you. I will keep your divine countenance always before my eyes and the secret knowledge of your divinity locked deep within my heart. So, in keeping with devotees of the goddess Isis, I will close with this thought. Be of good courage. Well, good night, listeners, and may the great She embrace you in her golden wings.